Hi, how do you do? I'm Donna Bannon, and I'm the organizer of this panel, and the panel, the second part of the panel that will be coming in the slot just after this one. They're both called Boba Class and Law, and they're linked panels. The way this is, let me give you the overview of how this is going to work so you feel that you have a roadmap of where we're going to be going. We have three people who will be presenting on this panel. They will get to speak each for 20 minutes. I am a ruthless timekeeper, and I'll send Jim Pope to snarl at them or something, because I think he could do that snarling kind of thing. He's too sweet. Anyway, so we will then have about 20-25 minutes for discussion afterward. There are two of us representing in the second panel. We will each get 20 minutes, and then there'll be much more time to discuss everybody on both panels. So we'll have to have kind of a summary discussion as well. So we're going to go in the order that people are listed in the program. The reason I do that is that people kind of expect to be able to walk in sometimes to part of a panel, and there's a better chance of hitting the people they want to see. So we'll go with Colin White, then Henry Alfonso, and then Carla Pratt. So there you go.
Thank you. I'm going to talk today about a famous strike that some of you are already familiar with, the Little Steel Strike, which occurred in the summer of 1937. Like most strikes, and certainly strikes of this magnitude, it provides a simple characterization in terms of its causes, its scope, its effects, its legacy and implications. And so it's impossible to speak accurately in broad generalities about many aspects of this project. Nevertheless, what we do as academics and commentators is to try to make sense of the complicated. And so I will try to overlay the story of this project with a couple of dominant, and I hope provocative, and I also hope accurate themes or characterizations. If you've ever read anything about the Little Steel Strike, you've probably seen it accompanied by the adjectives tragic and bitter. Every word that's written about the strike features that, and that it was. The strike began formally on May 26, 1937, at 11 p.m. Major shift changes in basic steel mills and also some ancillary mills as well. It was quite a large strike, not the largest of its day, but it entailed about 90,000 steel workers and maybe 10 to 20,000 sympathy strikers. The strike lasted through much of the summer and began to peter out in late June of that year. At some mills, workers remained on strike for a couple of as much as 2 years, but for many months at a number of the mills. It's called the Little Steel Strike. Some of you already know this, not because the companies involved were little in any absolute sense of the word. I remember teaching a case involving a little steel company, and one of my students thought it was like, you know, a mom and pop operation, kind of counterposed themselves to Starbucks and Walmart and that sort of thing. These were very, very large companies, every one of them among the top 100 firms in size and revenue in the United States in 1937. Republic Steel, Youngstown Sheet Tube Company, Inland Steel, and Bethlehem Steel. There are a couple of other companies involved, but not involved directly in the strike. At least 16 people were killed in the course of the strike. All of them unionists. 10 were killed in this episode, which some of you have seen. It's a famous piece of newsreel footage taken on Memorial Day, May 30th, 1937, in a field a few hundred yards away from the main gate of the Republic Steel mill located in South Chicago. This film footage resides now in the National Film Registry. Many of you, I'm sure, have seen various excerpts of it. I'm only showing a small part of it. And it captures an event that has the depth of 10 minutes. As Eugene Debs once said, the class struggle will be healed. Either in film. Now, the strike, and I'll let this finish, I'll continue talking because I let this disturbing footage unfold. The strike it occupies an enormously important place in the course of the timeline of American labor history. For one thing, it was the first major strike after the Jones and Laughlin decision, which came down April 16, 1937. So after the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, was essentially declared constitutional, as they sometimes say. And so in that sense, it was a real test of the new statute. Unlike the big strikes that occurred beforehand, which occurred in the shadow of unconstitutionality of the labor law, the law was unequivocally constitutional when this strike occurred. The strike was also the first major defeat of the CIO in its otherwise spectacularly successful, until that point, campaign to organize mainly industrial workers. It's important in that sense. The strike is important in both of those senses, in part because it was a resounding defeat for labor. There is no way to say that the strike was won, at least not in the short or medium term. What I want to talk about, though, is the longer-term importance of the strike. I'm writing a book about it, and I could sit here all day and regale you with more or less interesting commentary about different episodes of the strike, but that obviously is not going to happen. What I want to talk about instead is the legacy of the strike. And on that score, there is controversy. There is a fairly dominant narrative about the strike, especially in general labor histories, histories of the CIO, that views the strike as a short-term tragedy and a long-term triumph. That the strikers were defeated on the picket line, they unequivocally were, but that in the long run they prevailed. Now, part of that narrative invokes the authority of the NLRB, the NLRA, the administrative state. And so the point is, and I'm simplifying it, but the point is usually rendered something like this. The strikers lost that battle on the picket line, but they won recognition and lasting collective bargaining rights by skillful use of the machinery of the NLRB. And indeed, in 5 years' time, the little steel companies were all under contract with the steel workers. What began as the Steel Workers Organizing Committee, the SWOC, or SWI, as some people say, and later became, in the summer of 1942, United Steel Workers of America. So the companies were under contract within 5 years' time, and sometimes, oftentimes, this is treated as primary evidence of the belated victory of organizing. Victory snatched from the jaws of defeat and tragedy. That's what it is. My main thesis, main point today, is to challenge that and to say that that narrative is partly true, but only partly true. And that alongside this triumph is a lasting defeat of epic proportions incurred in this strike. In the following senses, the Little Steel Strike, again, because it occurred after Jones and Laughlin was decided, is a uniquely salient measure of the Wagner Act, of the CIO's organizing drive, and of the New Deal. And on all of those fronts, the strike tended to speak very poorly, negatively, to continued efficacy and value of those institutions and the organizing effort. The strike exposed the Wagner Act's weaknesses. It exposed the weaknesses of the NLRB. It exposed the weaknesses of the CIO New Deal alliance with the Roosevelt administration. And it exposed those things in ways that remain relevant to this day. It exposed lasting congenital defects in the legal regime that have a lasting influence, which can be seen even today and ever since in modern labor relations. I'll say a little bit more about that, and then I'll wrap it up. The strike, above all, revealed the inadequacy of the remedial structure and processes of the National Labor Relations Act and of the NLRA. The story of the strike and the litigation surrounding the strike is one of almost chaos initially, as conscientious reformers who were then dominant in the NLRB struggled to find a way to hold these companies to account, and struggled for the most part unsuccessfully in the sense that they did nothing to prevent the strike breaking the organizing drive. It would be years before the remedies provided by the Act were realized by the 7,000 or so people who were essentially fired in the aftermath of the strike, denied the estate. It did nothing to remedy the injuries directly inflicted on the people involved in the strike. Not everyone was killed as a strike, only a few actually were. But about 320 people were fairly seriously injured in the strike, almost all of the union people and union supporters. Nothing was done directly under the statutory regime to remedy what was inflicted on those people. And the momentum on the organizing drive was devastated. And devastated in ways that the law, even today, could do nothing to prevent. The other weakness the strike exposed, and this is even more fundamental, concern the right to strike and the strength of that right. If you know labor law, you know that the linchpin of American labor law is the right to strike. We don't have very much of a corporatist system of labor law. The government doesn't write contracts for parties in labor disputes. It leaves it to their respective economic weapons to vindicate their interest or needs or aspirations of collective bargaining. What this little steel strike showed was how weak the right to strike is. Again, even at this time, prior to the Taft-Hartley Act, further weakening the right to strike. And that was true in a number of ways, the most prominent of which is the simple fact that even had the steel companies not resorted to extraordinary acts of violence and repression, they probably still would go to the strike. The strikers were driven back to work by economic desperation. The fundamental advantage of employers in this relationship showed itself. And that's evident in the narrative, in the relevant sources, the recollections of the strikers themselves, as well as the CIO leadership. In a related way, the strike also exposed the inadequacy of the picketing weapon or tactic, as defined under the law at the time. So these people who were killed in the footage I showed you were killed by Chicago police, who were preventing them from establishing a mass picket line at the plant in South Chicago. The law at the time, the labor law, did not ban mass picketing. It still doesn't explicitly, but implicitly it does under many, if not most, circumstances. But what the law, not the labor law, but the local law did at the time, not just in Chicago, but all over the country, was put local authorities in a position with no regard to the labor law to intervene in these disputes with injunctions or proclamations. That was very common during the course of this strike, authored by police, forget judicial injunctions, proclamations authored by police, truncated the right to strike, who said you can only have 5 or 10 or 15 people on these picket lines. You can't have an enormous display of solidarity or support, let alone to coerce people on the line, would-be replacement workers from going into the plant. The other thing, and this is the last major theme that I'll talk about, or the second to last major theme I'll talk about, has to do with provocation. A case involving Republic Steel in Ohio, where Republic, that was a Republic stronghold back then, existed. The major, you know, the NLRB case, emanating from the Republic Mills in Ohio, was appealed to the Supreme Court. And it was appealed on a couple of questions, one of which was the authority of the NLRB to reinstate strikers who were implicated in violence in the course of the strike. The NLRB and the strikers won a victory of sorts, but an uncertain one. And at the end of the day, the NLRB prevailed in its claim that it was not obliged to deny reinstatement to the strikers simply because they had been implicated but not convicted of criminal acts, acts of violence. That was the victory part. The defeat was that the workers then were, by being provoked to violence, and they were provoked to very frequent acts of violence, frequent acts of violence, were maneuvered into a position by the steel companies that cost them considerable political support. Let me say that differently. Didn't so much cost them support as it did put elites whose support for them was uncertain in the first place in a position to renounce the strike and the organizing effort. And so Franklin Roosevelt very notoriously, infamously, pronounced upon the strike, he invoked Shakespeare, it's a curse upon both of their houses. And that marked the retreat of the federal government from its efforts, which were desultory to begin with, to negotiate an end to this dispute. And that problem remains, as we all know, a very serious problem in labor relations today. You get provoked, you lose. We provoke you, you lose. We kill you on the picket lines, you lose. You always lose when a strike is driven to this level of violence. Now, I'll make one more point, and then I'll wrap it up. There's one other legacy of the Little Steel Strike that's quite often ignored, and that is the very important role that the strike played in the politics that led to Taft Hartley. It was not the only strike that was important to that effort, that 10-year effort to finally amend the labor law along lines much more favorable to the business community. The sit-down strikes were also central to that narrative. But so was the Little Steel Strike. And the irony there is an obvious one. 16 or 18 people get killed, all of them unionists. And yet, employers and their allies in Congress and then business community and trade associations nevertheless were very successful in creating, propagating a narrative that said, this is because the labor law overprotects labor rights. This is because the NLRB overprotects labor rights. That's why 18 people were killed. And in some cases, they were more crass than that. They didn't bother to say, to couch it in terms of injury inflicted on labor, on unions. They said that the real victims of the strike, despite that balance sheet of death and injury, was the employers and the workers who wanted to cross the picket lines. And so there is a legacy here, and it's a very unfortunate one. And it's one that we continue in labor to live with today. I'll leave it at that. I'm happy to take up questions.
Okay, thank you. Later, yeah. There are a couple people who walked in. We're going to have questions and discussion at the end of all the presentations. Okay, next will be Ellen Foster.
Thanks, Ellen. And thanks for, as usual, setting up these panels. And also thanks to Stony Brook for hosting this wonderful conference. My talk is about the role of employee voice in protecting job security. Job security is a topic I've been very interested in for a long time. It's actually what I wrote my doctoral dissertation on back in the mid-90s. When I was attending graduate school in the mid-90s, unemployment was fairly high. It was the highest unemployment rate since 1981-82. It's much higher today. One of the reasons I decided to write about unemployment and job security is because I knew it would come back. It's cyclical. So even if, I think we're around 10% unemployment right now, even if we get back down to 6 or 5% unemployment, it will go back up. It may not go up to 10, it might go higher, but it will. It is a problem in modern advanced capitalist societies. It's also a problem that obviously is doesn't just affect the United States, but affects Europe and other countries and other parts of the world. Now, we know that there are dignity harms associated when workers are terminated, especially when they're terminated for cause, even if they don't feel they were engaged in misconduct. But I think many people don't associate dignity harms associated with the layoff or the plant closing. I don't think that's fair. I think there's many harms to workers when they are laid off, even though they can say, well, it wasn't my fault that I was laid off. I think there are many, many harms associated with this. And so I'm interested in exploring what that is. I also think that this is just slightly repeating what I said, this is important and significant because even if all of the promises all the most enlightened promises of technological advancement and globalization come true, so better society, higher wages, we will have cyclical unemployment. So I think this is something we need to wrap our minds around. I am presenting this paper in four parts. I just did my introduction. I'm going to then give some short economic observations about wages and managers and what managers tend to do in times of economic recession. Then I'm going to talk about what the current role of the law is, mostly drawing upon American law, but also looking and drawing upon some other law. And then I'd like to talk about a solution or a potential solution that I think would dignify workers and also allow them to be part authors of their own lives, what I call the autonomous dignified worker. That's my catchphrase, but I think other people write about the basic values of labor law as reflecting autonomy and dignity. Okay, some economic observations. Workers are generally more vulnerable in times of economic recession. One of the reasons for this is because firms are more vulnerable in times of economic recession. Right? So firms are under more economic pressure to cut costs during economic contraction, and in the short run, those costs they're going to cut variable costs. And what are variable costs? Labor. And labor costs could be wages, benefits, or just cutting the person, the layoff. Now, in the long run, anything can be cut. So they can close the plant, or they can shut down some of the machinery, or sell machinery. They can downsize. But in the short run, firms obviously are going to go after their variable costs first. But the question is, why do firms prefer to lay off rather than cut wages? It's not always true, but it's pretty broad that's what firms will do. And in economics, we call to understand that, you have to understand that what this economic concept, which is wages are sticky downwards. In other words, wages, once they get to a certain rate, it's hard to get them down. Okay, so there's data on that. I'm not an economist, but that's out there in the economic literature. Now, managers might try to cut wages in invisible ways at first. So in the beginning of a recession, what managers might try to do is say, make you pay for your benefits. The cost of the benefit increases. So you don't feel like your wages are actually being lowered. But eventually, that's not enough if the recession is bad enough. And eventually, managers are faced with the layoff or the wage cut. Now, were the managers to ask labor might collectively decide they'd rather have a wage cut than having their colleagues be fired. Maybe, maybe not. But there's usually no discussion about that. So let me go to the next part of my talk, part three, which is the bulk of my talk, which is to describe some of the law about to explain how the law interacts with this this economic reality. And are there any, are there mostly, who's not a lawyer in this room? Okay, so I assume that everyone except for the speakers would be non-lawyers. All right. The default rule in the United States is what's called at-will employment, which you probably, most of you know, which means an employer may terminate an employee for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason at all. Unless, and these are more recent unlesses, it used to be that with, you know, employers can do whatever they wanted, unless there's a reason prohibited by law. So for example, employers can't fire people today because they're a woman or because they're because of their race. That's Title VII. Okay, but for the most part, unless there's an actual protected class, the default rule is employers can fire people for even bad reasons. They don't like the color of your hair. Okay? The law typically views economic reasons, well, it's a bad economy, as a good reason for firing people. Okay? So in other words, the law privileges a manager's decision to lay off and close plants unilaterally without thinking that maybe workers actually have an interest in this whole process. So the law privileges managers in this way. And it ignores the harms, the very real human rights harms to the workers. I also don't think I've developed this in another paper that is even economically efficient to do this, but even putting aside whether the economic argument, it's certainly, I think we can all agree, there's a certain human rights harm there. Okay, so another thing we have to understand is that this didn't have to be the law. This idea that workers have no protection during economic contraction. There's other models we can think of. And some of those models were at least would be something like from the zero protection of at will to at least advanced notification, to some sort of information about the financial distress of the firm, consultation rights, bargaining rights, and we'll talk about bargaining and effects bargaining, and even to co-determination, where the workers actually have a co-say with what happens to the firm. I'm not going to talk about co-determination at all today because we don't even have it in the United States, and there's there are parts of the world that do have, there's some stuff in Germany, for example, but let's just put co-determination off to the side, and it's not even the solution that I go for, because I tend to be a pragmatic idealist. So that's not going to happen in the United States anytime soon, co-determination. Let me go through each of those categories after at will. Notice. The purpose of notice is to, or at least a purpose of notice, is to give workers and their families transition time to adjust to the prospective loss of employment, to seek and obtain alternative jobs, and if necessary, to enter skills training or retraining, which would allow the workers to successfully compete in the job market. At least you have notice so you can do some of these things. In the United States, there is a notice period if the employer qualifies under the federal legislation, and that's called the WARN Act. And that requires managers to give advance notice to workers or their representatives of a job loss. But it has to be a mass economic dismissal or a plant closing, and it has to meet the definitions of those terms in the statute. Those definitions are very limited. They're limited by the size of the employer, so the employer has to be fairly large. They're limited by the number of employees laid off or terminated. They're limited by the length of the layoff and even the reasons for the layoff. So just focusing on some of the reasons, for example, if there's an unforeseen business, some sort of unforeseen business problem, then the employer is not liable to give any notice. And some of the case law as to what's unforeseen strikes, at least me and my students, as very foreseeable. So for example, when there was fraud in the company it certainly is foreseeable that if there's fraud that the government might actually investigate that, which would cause the firm to lose a lot of clients, That was seen as, that was considered by the courts as unforeseeable. So one has to question whether the employer, who certainly was in the better position to foresee this, should have had the burden of, should have been able to, should have carried, the law should have made the employer carry that burden rather than the worker. There's also another exception that is called the faltering company exception, and if you want, you can ask me questions about that one. Information, the purpose of giving information is to give workers information sufficient to make decisions about their working lives. So the point here is that, well, first of all, that under U.S. law, workers are only entitled to information if they're, for the most part, if they're in a union. If they aren't in a union, that's under the National Labor Relations Act or some various other statutes, then it's a well-established duty, the employer has a well-established duty to furnish relevant information to unions, which includes the information to substantiate a wage cut. So in that case, there's some protection that the union understands, okay, wait, there really isn't any money here, well, we can now talk about it. So this is like a prerequisite to meaningful bargaining, which I'm going to get to in a minute. But there is no right to information in the at-will situation, which is most of the United States. Consultation's a little bit different from bargaining. Consultation requires managers to consult or talk to workers for making decisions about a layoff. It's just about talking. But in Europe, it's a pretty strong right. It has to be done prior to making any decisions. Even if the employer is contemplating the mass layoff, it has to initiate, it triggers this right of consultation. And the duty, it is, the purpose of this is to compel discussion about the ways and means of avoiding the mass economic dismissal. We can compare that to the negotiation right in the United States, which is to purpose or to foster the practice and procedure of collective bargaining between employees and their and the employer, the employers and employee representatives. This right is protected under Section 7 of the Act, which is the keystone of all the rights that are granted to workers. But it's also limited in the United States. It does not compel either side to make concessions, only to bargain in good faith with a view toward reaching an agreement, not to come to an agreement. And plant closings, the decision to plant to close the plants is privileged. In other words, the employer doesn't have to bargain over the decision to close the plants. However, the employer must bargain over the effects of that decision. So a skillful negotiator, or a union negotiator, would be able to bring out a lot of the important important discussion that would need to be done about that decision, maybe even convince the employer that the decision is a bad one. But there is no duty on the employer to discuss, to bargain over the actual decision. Okay, let me give you, because I have about 3 minutes, my solution, or a solution, what I really would love to have discussion on. I think we need to expand the law's role to compel bargaining or at least consultation over mass economic dismissals, whether in the union or the non-union setting. I think it has to include, it has to require employers to gather information, to hand over that information about their financial records. It has to arm workers with this information to persuade, so that this way that the workers can persuade employers what they want to do to help the firm survive. Because workers obviously want their firm to survive because they want the job. I think the scope of the right has to be at least as broad as the European Union directive, which means that they have to discuss ways and means of avoiding the layoffs and some other things. And since I only have about 30 seconds. Let me finish, let me flesh this out a little bit better. Let me try to go through my solution, okay? Which is the very last thing I'm going to talk about. So I want to compel bargaining over these mass economic dismissals and this plan closing. And we can call it consultation if you want. I think it should be done prior to the decision. And I said it requires all that information gathering and turning over of that information. One thing good about it is the firms don't have to worry about a backlash because the employees become part of the decision. Now, that means there's also important ways that you don't want your workers to be co-opted. Okay? You have to talk about how you do that. I think the scope has to be at least as broad as the European Union directive, which I think I said the ways and means of avoiding, which would include the ways and means of avoiding layoffs or plant closure. The number of workers that might be affected, their job categories, this would all have to be discussed. What if mitigating consequences, social measures, retraining, redeployment, things like that would have to be discussed in this sort of social plan. The reasons for the projected dismissals would have to be discussed. Okay. This would also alleviate the firm's concern that their so-called good productive workers would exit as soon as they hear that there's going to be layoffs, because the workers can actually work out a plan to stay there. Now, firms don't want their experienced workers to exit because those are the most productive workers. I have one more thing to say. The other thing here that we'd have to work out is how would the representatives be selected in the non-union setting in a way that would not undercut unions. Right now, the Department of Labor is working on these safety committees across which is something that they started working on after I was writing about this. So I've been thinking about this problem for a while. And now the Department of Labor wants to have these safety committees in union and non-union with workers' representatives. So this could be a possible way of selecting workers in all firms. But I would love to hear from you about what you think about that and whether there is a way of doing this that would not undercut unions. Thank you very much.
Affirmative action really isn't needed anymore because all all the people who are getting into law school come from the affluent class and, or the middle class. And so, we really don't need that. We don't need affirmative action anymore. We think the whole purpose was to help people get out of the projects and get an education. So that's not happening anymore, so we don't need that. The way we set up the study was to approach the American Bar Association, which has a list of all the lawyers throughout the country, and the National Bar Association, which is the National African American Bar. And we asked them to contact their members and let their members know about the study, and we set up a website where the members could voluntarily sign up for the study. And we found that, and we had a little picture of ourselves on the website, and we found that we were not getting any bites. So then we went to a conference, the National Bar Association, and we found we were getting really a chilly reception, and I was like, I don't understand why people don't want to talk to us. And so we were off having dinner one night, and we asked a group of conference participants if we could join them, and we said, we're just really at a loss because no one really wants to talk to us. And so this African-American lawyer sat back and he said, well, I think that's because people are wondering what's a white lady, my friend Dory, and a Hispanic lady so interested about black people in the bar. And I just kind of laughed to myself because at that moment it appeared to me that I am racially ambiguous, but I self-identify as African-American and have since birth. And my colleague Dory, her interest in this project comes because, not because she's African American, she's a white lady, but because she comes from a working class background, she's actually from a part of Long Island called Rockaway. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that. And I wasn't familiar with it until I met Dory, and she's told me lots of stories about Rockaway and Broad Channel and what it was like to grow up in that working class neighborhood. So that is our background and our interest kind of in coming to this project. I also come from a working class family. I grew up on a farm in rural Oklahoma, and I can really relate to the panel this morning where one of the panelists talked about her student wanting to leave community college and go to work on Wall Street, and how sometimes outlandish that can sound, because I remember as a rural, the daughter of a rural, society in Oklahoma in the early 70s, telling people that I wanted to be a lawyer when I'd never seen a black lawyer nor a woman lawyer, and hearing their response like, that's cute little girl, like it was an impossibility, right? And so one of the things that came out of our study was that we had 28 participants eventually sign up for the first wave of the study, and 16 of them were from working class or lower households, which really surprised us. Because of that narrative that you hear, we thought that most of them would be from more affluent families. And a common recurring theme that we heard from these participants was that their families did not have the highest of expectations for them in terms of aspirations. That their families wanted them to get an education so that they could get a good job. But a good job was often defined as something that's stable, maybe with union protection, something that was a school teaching position, or a job in a hospital. Those were the good jobs. So aspiring to law was kind of like the guy on the panel this morning said, that was like insanity. What are you, crazy? You're reaching beyond your means there. And so a lot of these young lawyers heard that early on, but nonetheless aspired to law. And interestingly enough, African Americans as a group have the highest aspiration for law than any other racial group. And that's perhaps because they, as a group, understand that law has had a significant transformative effect in the lives of African American people. But despite the fact that African Americans as a group aspire to law at a much higher rate, they have the highest shutout rate of school do not get admitted to any law school. So the overwhelming majority of blacks who are applying to law school are not getting in. And we said, well, why is that? You know, if people are knocking at the door, why aren't they getting in? And this is in a world where we have race-conscious affirmative action. And so one of the things that we looked at was the barriers, right? What are the barriers that are keeping people from getting in? And one of the common refrains that we heard from people in the study was the inadequacy of their education prior to law school. And that people realize the inadequacy of their education at different points in time. So there were participants who whose parents realized the inadequacy of their education for them and struggled to provide alternative means for them to get supplemental education, let's say. So there were parents who heard about some magnet school and applied for their children to get into that school. Or there were parents who heard about an opportunity for a better education outside of the general public school system, but it was still public school education, and so they applied for their children to have that opportunity. But some of our kids languished in subpar schools throughout their K-12 experience, Luke being, of course we've assigned pseudonyms to all the participants, but Luke being probably one of the most memorable. Luke told me that he went to inner city public school in New York City, and that he had several gym periods throughout the day, so physical fitness was emphasized, and that and he frequently had teachers who would basically seek to entertain the students rather than to teach because discipline was a problem in the classroom, and showing videos was a way to keep students contained and quiet. And so he shared with me that he saw Silence of the Lambs in third grade. so this was the education that he was getting. He got to law school, well, first of all, let me back up. He graduated from high school, a vo-tech high school in New York, and then enrolled in a community college, and wasn't sure what he was going to study. One of his friends said, why don't you become a paralegal? And he said, what's that? Okay, so another common thing that we're seeing with respect to working class kids is that they don't understand the way society's ordered. They don't understand the various jobs that are available, right? He didn't understand what a paralegal was. It was some unknown job to him, right? So the person said, it's somebody who helps a lawyer. And so he decides, okay, I'll do that. So he enrolls in paralegal class, and the first class that he sits in is taught by a female lawyer. And she writes on the board, paralegals make, you know, $29,000 a year, lawyers make $97,000 a year. And so she told him, if you aspire to get a college degree, you could go to law school, you can make even more money. Because a lot of people who become paralegals can definitely become lawyers if they continue their education. So he said he wrote it on the top of his paper, lawyers, $97,000. He said, at that moment, he said, well, I'm going to be a lawyer. Not understanding what it would take to get there, right? Not knowing that there was another hurdle that he would have to overcome after he obtained a bachelor's degree, and that would be the LSAT. And the LSAT, the law school admissions test, is probably the largest hurdle for African-American students, particularly those from working class backgrounds. We know from studies that have been conducted by LSAC, which is the organization that administers the LSAT test, that performance on the LSAT test correlates strongly with the socioeconomic status of the family from which the test taker comes. It correlates more so to socioeconomic status than it does to how they're actually going to perform in law school, which is tragic. Why are people using this test? Why are law schools using this test? Because it's the only test that's on the market right now that's approved for use by ABA-approved law schools. Law schools are accredited by the American Bar Association, And you want to be accredited as a law school, because if you're not accredited, then in most jurisdictions, your graduates are not going to be able to sit for the bar, because one of the requirements for being eligible to take the bar exam, which is the competency exam to get licensed as a lawyer, is that your law school is ABA accredited, that you are a graduate of an ABA accredited law school. So law schools have to use this test because the ABA requires that law schools use an entrance exam to gauge fitness for law study, whether students are fit for law study or not. And so the only test in the marketplace right now is the LSAT. There have been studies done on the LSAT. Most agree that the LSAT is not a racially or culturally biased exam. However, there is this socioeconomic bias, if you will. I mean, why is it then that the test correlates so highly with socioeconomic status of its takers? And so because, so let me add this other piece. Law schools are also ranked, right? So not every law school is, not all law schools are equal in the eyes of the consumers who attend law schools, right? And so students are trying to decide, well, what law school am I going to go to? One of the key drivers for determining which law school they're going to go to is the rank of the law school. So law schools understand that they need to improve their rank in order to attract the best and the brightest students, and so law schools are constantly trying to improve their rank. Who does the ranking? U.S. News and World Report, a media outlet, conducts an annual survey of the law schools, gathers data, and publishes a ranking of all of the law schools. Interestingly enough, some of the things that you and I might consider important in education, U.S. News does not, but that's a whole other talk. But one of the things that they consider highly important, and one of the things that is most municipal, right, in terms of if you're a law school, one of the data points that you can manipulate easily is the LSAT scores of the people that you admit to your law school, right? You can manipulate that more easily than you can your reputational score, which is, you know, they send out these surveys to people and they say, you know, how would you rate Penn State, right? How would you rate the faculty there? And you assign a number. That score is hard to manipulate, right? Because it's hard to influence what other people think about you. And people tend to think, you know, the same way about an institution for a long period of time. So, you know, Harvard is always number one or number two or number three, right? And so one of the ways that we can perhaps improve our rank is to improve the LSAT scores of students that we're admitting, right? And so the median LSAT score for an entering class becomes crucial in deciding a law school's rank, which means that it becomes crucial in deciding who to admit to your law school if you're striving to be the highest ranked law school that you can possibly be. Now, why would people even care about rank? Because you want to be well-ranked because if you are an academic leader of your institution, i.e. the dean, your performance is measured in part by how your institution is viewed by those out there who are considering attending it and those who are considering making contributions, financial contributions, alums, and the like. And so you do not want your ranking to plummet because alums are not going to be happy, right? If the value of their degree is deflated because the law school is plummeting in the rankings. You don't want to remain stagnant because that means you will plummet because other schools are playing the ranking game and they're trying to climb the ladder. So even if you continue with the status quo, you're subject to plummet. And so all schools are playing this game where they basically play with the numbers. There are other data points that can be manipulated. I think some of you may have read about the University of Illinois, which was because there's an index assigned for how many dollars are spent per capita per student. And so they were counting the fair market value of the Lexis and Westlaw services that were provided to students, which they didn't pay for, right? Because Lexis and Westlaw are providing the services as a marketing tool to try to get students hooked in law school so they'll use them once they become lawyers. And so that kind of gamesmanship is going on to try to improve the ranking of your law school. The LSAT test, therefore, becomes a key hurdle for African American students because most of them who take the test score below the national median, okay? Which means then that there's a disincentive for law schools to accept African-American students, which is perhaps why we do not see, despite the fact that over the past 15 years we've seen an increase in the number of law school seats because there's been an increase in the number of law schools that are approved by the ABA, we've not seen an increase in the number of blacks admitted to law schools. So in other words, despite the fact that there were all these additional seats added, black students were not occupying them. So one of the things that we heard through the study was the difficulty that students encounter with respect to the LSAT. Despite the fact that many of them took a review course and tried to prepare themselves for the test, many of them shared with us that they did not perform as well on the test as they had hoped. Why? Why is this? Perhaps it's because of the inferior education that they've gotten at each step along the way, right? And so one of the things that we're hoping to do is to identify some of the educational interventions that could help working class kids supplement their education, right? Because many times these students had some kind of intervention that helped bring them along. So for Luke, who learned in law school that he did not understand what a pronoun was or what subject verb agreement was. Right? How did he get that far, right, without understanding that is amazing. But at least he recognized it at some point. He said, this is a deficiency that I have to cure. Went to the law school writing specialist, right? And you have to appreciate how law schools work, because many law schools do not have strong academic support programs. Kind of like you're thrown in and you're supposed to either sink or swim. And if you can't swim, then you just sink, and that's too bad. So law schools that have strong academic support programs, we think will be better for kids from working class backgrounds. And I'll just mention the last hurdle that we see coming up in a lot of the narratives is that Luke and many of these other kids had to work both during college and during law school. And while you might think working in college is perhaps the norm, working in law school is not the norm. In fact, the ABA tells us that we are to admonish kids coming in the door that they are not to work their first year, and during the second and third year, they are not to work any more than 20 hours a week. That rule that you cannot work in the first year is an impossibility for many of our kids from working class families. And so they break the rule, they work, but they pay the price, because the time that they spend working is time that other kids spend studying. And law school is a competitive graded environment. So unlike college, where if everybody does well in some of the college classes, you could assign everybody an A and a B because they earn that. In law school, you have to grade on curve. And so there have to be some people at the bottom. And so that puts disproportionately our working class kids at the bottom in terms of law school grades, which then places them in a difficult situation in terms of job placement, because legal employers frequently look at grades as the number one indicator of hireability, right, in terms of whether you're going to be a good employee with their firm. So working class kids seem to have a lot of disadvantages, and I won't touch on the race part because I don't have time, but the intersection of class and race certainly is felt by these kids as they navigate law school, and many of them share their stories, and I'd be happy to talk about questions about that after the panel.
Well, and even now.
Okay, well, we have 25 minutes for conversation.
Last speaker, was there anything in your study that led you, gave you any sort of reason to believe that having more working class kids or more working class kids of color go through law school would have an effect on the kinds of things the previous two speakers were talking about? I mean, in a sense, is the goal to get more, to sort of change the complexion of the legal profession that could be just as sort of hostile and sort of pro-business, anti-worker as before. It would just have slightly different. I couldn't tell from your talk if you had a sense of, are you going to get a different outcome, or are you just going to have a different population going through an education system that's going to prepare them for the same kind of law system?
I think a little of both. So in a previous article, I wrote about the importance of diversity in law school. And I think, and this is purely anecdotal, but I do some diversity training for the legal services lawyers in Pennsylvania. These are lawyers who provide legal services to people who cannot afford to pay for them. And what I see at those trainings is I ask people, how many are from working class or poor backgrounds? And overwhelmingly, 90% of them raise their hand, right? And so I think people who come from these backgrounds are more sensitive to the needs of people in those socioeconomic groups. Not all of them who come through law school, who come from lower income families, are going to go into legal services. Clearly not. But when you look at the people who are doing legal services work, it tends to be people who have a connection to those communities. So I wrote an article about why it's important to have diversity in the legal profession. And I think it's because racial diversity in particular. So when African Americans become lawyers, they don't shed their African American identity, they don't shed their connection to that community. And so we tend to see even black lawyers who go into large corporate law firms using that status, leveraging that status to help their community, right? So they might not be doing pro bono work themselves, but they might be writing a check to legal services, or they might be getting their law firm to write an even bigger check to legal services, right? And so I do think that having people from those groups in our society in the ranks of lawyer is very important. And not all people who graduate from law school are types of lawyers, right? So most of our politicians, many of them have legal training. And so when you have somebody in the legislature, right, who can relate to labor, right, and say, well, we need to do something. We need to pass a law that says, that people have to sit down at a table and talk to workers before they make a decision, a unilateral decision to just lay off people. Because I've seen it time and time again in articles where workers decide they will take a pay cut, collective pay cut, to keep everybody on board the ship, right, instead of rolling the dice and risking that they'll be one of the ones cut. But I think there are some who, when I ask my kids first years, how many of you come to law school because you want to make a difference in society? Only a few raise their hand. When I ask them, how many of you come to law school because you want to live a solid, financially secure lifestyle? The overwhelming majority. And that's the reason they're in law school. And that bothers me because, I went to law school for the former reason, and so... The whole idea of lawyers as social engineers, I'm afraid, is starting to dissipate.
Yes, John.
Yeah, this is a fascinating panel, and I have a number of questions, but I'll start with this one for Anne-Marie. I work in a unionized faculty situation. And we have the right to consultation. The administration must consult with faculty union before embarking on any layoffs. But what's happened is, in addition to a lot of what you lay out, a structural change in academic employment, which is mirrored in the private sector as well, of contingent employment, that is to say, faculty whose appointment is contingent on budget or enrollment, and this means they can lay people, well, they don't call it a layoff, it's non-reappointment, and so as the percentage of faculty who are contingent has reached approximately 50%, when hit with the recent budget crisis. We lost about 10% of our faculty, but never were there any consultations or layoffs. And so I wonder if you, again, as part-time and contracted and contingent employment situations have become more common in our economy, I wonder if your model has kind of wrestled with how you might address that huge and growing loophole, even for unionized workplaces.
Let me ask you a question first. Do you have a collective bargaining agreement?
Yeah.
Well, the first thing I would say is that probably when you renegotiate that collective bargaining agreement is to clarify that, okay? Because that's what always happens, right? As you negotiate things, or as there's successive collective bargaining agreements, employers or workers will find loopholes, and so you can close those loopholes. So I would certainly close that loophole. But
I was on
that
bargaining team. It's easier said than
done. I've been on bargaining teams too, and you're right, it's much easier said than done. That would be what I would be doing. I'm sure I'm already speaking to the choir when I say that, but for everyone else. Yes, I'm thinking about this a lot lately, and not only am I thinking about this, but a lot of people are thinking about this, but I'm thinking about it more in other papers, like the idea of vanishing employee. I know that Ellen has written a lot about what is an employee. I have a paper right now called The Vanishing Employee, and then the subtitle is Putting the Autonomous Dignified Union Worker Back to Work. And that's really just focusing on the labor laws. And then and the next one I was thinking of is exactly this, these contingent workers and what to do about that. The board started grappling with that question, the National Labor Relations Board, in the Clinton administration, and the dialogue stopped with the Bush 2 board.
Really?
Meaning, yeah, right. And the idea being that these are not really workers, meaning when you say that, they're obviously workers, but now statutory employees,
yeah.
So they don't have rights. And this is, so I think the first step in this is actually that, is to call, you call them what they really are, which is that they're workers, which they are employees, and they deserve the protections of the labor law. But that's, to use your word, easier said than done, because there's enormous political pressure to narrow labor law, to narrow the statutory definition of employee, to further weaken remedies, and to further weaken even the collective bargaining and conservative activity rights. So, no, I don't have an answer to it, except I think it's really important that we're thinking about it. I'm thinking about it right now in terms of how to expand the definition of employee, which I think is the very first step. So, and if you want, I can send you that. I'm almost done with that paper. I'd be happy to send that paper to you that I'm writing. I'd like to hear more about what you think about that. Yes. Oh, I should.
White, do you think that the Little Steel Strike was the high point of the labor upsurge in the 30s and was itself exposed other processes going on? You seem to be saying that the strike itself was kind of a pull the curtain away from a lot of weaknesses and problems in the NLRB and other, the Wagner Act and other advances of labor. I'm not sure if you're saying that the strike itself was a cause, but I'm just wondering if you see that as a high point.
Yes, with the following kind of contextualization of it, something I didn't say clearly in the talk. The strike was both a measure of the strength of the Wagner Act, the strength of the CIO's organizing efforts, and a contest between CIO, unionist, NLRB staffers on the one hand, and business interest on the other, and the courts to some extent, to decide what the law was going to be. The law was being made at the same time that it was tested. And In short, the CIO activists, and I'm generalizing because there were tensions within these organizations, their more ambitious program lost out. So one of the issues here was the right to mass picketing. Do you have the right to mass picketing? And then that was lost, in essence. Do you have the right to coerce workers not to cross the picket line or to make a show of solidarity with 1,000 people at a plant gate? And as we all know now, that is all but certain to be deemed coercive and thus an unfair labor practice under the Taft-Hartley amendments, but also enjoinable. So it was very much a high point in some ways, and it also, the defeat also influenced the composition of the CIO and the SWAC and USW, who decided, the leadership, Philip Murray in particular, David McDonald, who later became president of USW, they clearly calculated that they had lost more than they had gained by embracing militants and radicals in the ranks of the SWAT. And one doesn't have to have an over-idealized view of communist organizers like Gus Hall, Bobby Burke, John Stupin, all were prominent organizers in the steel drive. One doesn't have to have an over-idealized view of them to understand that they played an important role, and that once they were purged, and they were purged after the strike, it took something away from the CIO's drive. And the reason they were purged is that clearly McDonald and Murray and others in the CIO thought, well, the path for us now is through the law and through a strategy of appeasement with the Roosevelt administration and with moderates in the entire political system, and including the board. Including state politicians like Martin Dade, the governor of Ohio, who betrayed the strikers in that state. To me, it's important not to overemphasize the role of one strike, but if one strike ever did influence, as well as measure, the retrenchment of CIO organizing in the late 1930s, it was the
UMWA still coerces picket lines.
Oh yeah, I mean, you could, but
like Harlan County, USA. Is it?
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess this is for Carla. So I graduated from law school last year and decided I don't want to practice law, so I'm back to organizing for a variety of reasons. But one thing I found is that people hear that I have this law degree, and then, like, the younger students that I'm working with in particular want to talk about, they want to go to law school, so undergraduates and other people. And, you know, I'm working with a lot of working class undergraduates, and I have a really hard time recommending that track to people. You know, and I find, like, I have these conversations with people that are really tough because it costs so freaking much money. And the debt load is unbearable, and it's kind of like, I mean, maybe if you have parents who are going to pay that bill for you, it makes sense. But the other thing is that the job market for attorneys, whether you want to be like a Wall Street attorney right now or be, you know, working with legal services, is awful. And so one thing I kind of struggle with is just, and I don't know how much you looked at that, is just the finances of it, and especially if there's a difference with people that are recent graduates of law school and maybe people that graduated 20 years ago and what their experiences have been.
Yeah, no, I should say that one of the criteria for our study was that you self-identify as African American, you graduated between 2000 and 2007 from a law school in the U.S., and that you were admitted to the bar in at least one U.S. jurisdiction and that you were working in some field of law. So everybody who participated in our study was employed, and no one at the time that we interviewed them talked about difficulty getting employment, but all of them would have graduated and secured employment before the big crash in 2008, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're right. I mean, we have students across the country who graduated with degrees last year and this year and don't have jobs, and they're competing with people who were laid off who have experience, right? Who were willing to do those entry-level jobs for less money because they had suffered job losses in the there's this cascading effect in the marketplace that leaves a lot of new lawyers unemployed. And so, yeah, I think it's very important to counsel students coming in terms of the debt load that they're going to incur. But for working class kids, what I tell them is, I just got through telling a young woman this in Pennsylvania. She's from Virginia. She's a Penn State undergrad student who's interested in law. And I told her she needs to go to law school in Virginia because she can get an in-state tuition differential, which you can't get at Penn State because we're a quasi-state institution. Law school makes no difference in tuition whether you're in-state or out-of-state. But a lot of schools do make that difference, and that can be a huge, huge difference in terms of tuition. So students can save up to $140,000 by going to an in-state school. When you look at students in terms of choosing what law school they're going to go to, we did look in the study in terms of whether students from working class groups and African American students in particular were going to law school, the highest ranked law school that they got into, or were they taking money into account? And most of them were taking money into account. And one of them gave a narrative, he said he was just kind of heartbroken when he realized that he couldn't go to the law school, the highest ranked law school that he had gotten into, that he had to go to the state school. It's a reality, and it's an unfortunate reality, but I think it's a personal, individual decision. We have another woman who went to an Ivy League law school, and she said that she was banking, that she would get a job, and that she would pay it back, and it might take her 30 years to pay it back, but that Ivy League degree would be her ticket, right, for the rest of her life, and she was working at a large law firm at the time of the interview, so... It's a tough decision, and particularly for students who are from working class backgrounds, it may not be an option for them to opt in higher ranked law school because you cannot borrow enough federally guaranteed student loan money to cover tuition in both in the top 100 law schools and most of them. And so you have to borrow from the private marketplace, which means that your parents have to have good credit, strong credit rating, or you have to have that as a student, which if you're talking about a student who came directly from undergrad, the student isn't going to have that, so their parents are going to need it. And for most of these kids, their parents didn't have it, and so they worked, they tried to scrounge up scholarship money wherever they could, there are some loopholes that your financial aid advisor sometimes knows about. So, for example, this one woman, the financial aid officer, made a call to a private bank and used her grades as her credit because she was in the top quarter of the class. And the bank, based on her grades, made her the loan despite the fact that she had bad credit as a student and her parents didn't have credit to co-sign.
I wanted to just add one thing to your question from a slightly different angle. One of the things I've been advising students, my law students, is to look around and not just take the traditional track. And for example, to take a look at unions. We do research jobs and nonprofits. A lot of those places, the skills that you have as a lawyer can be very useful for you to use with some of these other jobs where you would be doing some social good on the side, or that would be the main purpose of it. Social good, but that's another place that they could go and use those kinds of skills. Yeah. So some of them are actually taking that course. Let me see. You had your hand up before.
I just have a question to the whole panel. I met Ahmad last night and he told me that he was teaching labor law. I said, "Is that in the Department of Antiquities?" it kind of seems like the labor movement and labor law is a dying part of our society. And if you look at American history, the law hasn't always been on the side of workers. So how do you prevent yourselves from becoming so frustrated when you see what happens? The example of reaching the highest pinnacle in the law is probably Eric Holder, who's now an Attorney General of the United States. And I read an interview with him, and the reporters noticed that he had a copy of the Douglas Blackman's book slated by another name on his desk. And I thought, if he really reads that book, he must be just so frustrated, because if you read that book, it's about how the law wasn't able to enforce the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War, and that slavery existed well into post-World War II, and the law just wasn't enough. It wasn't until the Civil Rights Act in the 60s that you finally got rid of this kind of abuse of workers. And, and Holder is also in a big bind because he could be prosecuting torturers like the kinds of people that were torturing workers, black workers, post-Civil War. And he can't do it because it's become a political decision not to. So with all these kinds of things going on, what gives you hope? Where do you, where do you get your hope that this is actually a way of giving some kind of justice? Instead, what does Billy Bragg say? This isn't a court of justice, this is a court of law.
I actually do not feel frustrated at all. I teach at West Virginia University, and I have a wait list for my labor law class, which is capped at 70. Every year I teach it, and then I teach advanced labor law in the spring, and this spring I had 38 students in that class. My students come in often knowing a lot of labor law already. A lot of my students are working class, are very committed to the labor movement, have taught me an enormous amount of more of the pragmatics that I didn't, even though I had been an attorney at the National Labor Relations Board for 10 years. They knew things I didn't know on a very pragmatic level. They are often the sons and daughters of coal miners. One of my students who just graduated, his high school was being used as a morgue for the miners who perished in the Big Red Branch explosion. So I don't know if I live in a bubble, but I'm extremely, I'm the opposite of frustrated where I am, where there is enormous thinking about how to reinvigorate the labor movement. We have a labor law society. The mission of our society is to educate the public about the rights of workers and why they're important. So now that's just one university, but I think that if each of us, obviously we care about labor law and that's why we teach it. And there are schools who don't offer labor law, which is really a shame. I'm not just because if you don't teach labor law, then people don't understand their rights. But actually, labor law teaches you about administrative law, constitutional law. It is such an interdisciplinarily rich endeavor that it's a huge mistake. But for the schools who are actually teaching it, and if people are dedicated and they care, which I think people who teach labor law really do care about it, the students are there, at least in my area of region of the world.
That doesn't, I don't know what you guys feel about it.
I've been teaching for right at 10 years now, and I guess I'm not discouraged because my expectations were never that great in the first place. And I don't mean that in the sense that I mean to disparage labor law, but I have a very dim view of law as an effective mechanism of social change. I always have. I have an epigram here that's just wonderful for this project of mine up in Sinclair, one of his typically crude novels about the little steel strikes in 1938. One of the actors says, one of the characters said, the purpose of the strike is to teach you what capitalism really is, to free you from the accepted falsehoods of your class. And if you substitute strife for my course in labor law, it would be a fair description of my aspiration in teaching that or criminal law. I mean, I don't think that the law is an engine of justice as a rule, or ever has in modern capitalist society or maybe ever will be. And so, yes, it's unfortunate that the union density is diminishing and the labor law is becoming more fraudulent in many ways than it was in the late 1930s. But, I start with the assumption that one should not expect much more. And I try to teach the kids that, because law school is, if nothing else, an ideological exercise. And institutions like indoctrinating students to accepted falsehoods of their class. Which include the notion that justice flows out of these legal processes, that we live in a pluralistic democratic society where people who are workers are somehow on par with
extremely wealthy people and corporations and, you know, other capitalist interests. And I do the class an opportunity to convince them that that's largely a lie, not always. So I'm not I'm discouraged by the background facts. I'm not discouraged by the class and the way it plays out, I guess.
I'm just going to respond to that and then really quickly. I know you have a question. I take a very different point of view. My view is that we have hundreds of people who fought, and some who died, as you can see in that video, for these rights that we have today. And if you ask yourself, in whose interest is it that you be cynical about these rights and say, you know, they're not worth a darn, let's just not enforce them, let's not, I'm not saying this is a you, I'm just saying one does this. Whose side are you on and who are you helping? And I'm just going to, you know, there's a saying that I think is really appropriate here, and that is that capitalism is more like a tiger than an onion. It resists being peeled with ferocity. So, you know, nobody said life was going to be easier, that this was going to be an easy struggle, and when you have rights, it's really important to really push hard for those rights to widen them, to strengthen them. And if you're not doing that, then and you just are passive, this isn't you, this is, if one is passive about this, you lose those rights, because capital is sure as hell pushing very, very hard on the other side. You had a question?
Yeah, my question was to you about the Memorial Day Massacre. And I'm not sure I can formulate this well. It's something I've been struggling with myself. But you ended your talk by talking about the way that business associations like NAM, which I've done some studying of, sort of use this instance and others to sort of shape a public discourse against labor. And I've been looking at the images and the ways in which images hurt labor in this period from like the 30s through the 50s. Even in this instance where typically this footage is seen by historians as something that vindicated labor. But the thing that I'm struggling with is this whole question of their sophistication with these public relations tactics that then enter into the public sphere. And labor's basic incapacity to get, and this may be my ignorance of law, but what I understand to be sort of First Amendment rights to assembly, you know, just to be there on the field. So can you talk about that a little bit, or am I just being very naive about
the nature of that, right?
Yeah. Because you were talking about it in terms of law.
Yeah.
Well, not just law, but excuse me, like law.
Basically, the parameters of the right to protest, or including picketing in the labor context, long before this episode, had evolved around a framework that relied on two questions to determine whether limits were appropriate. One was the purpose of the protest. That was unequivocally, in this case, acceptable or legitimate, but the other is the means employed, the way we structure the protest. And then now, local governments and in a roundabout way the NLRB are licensed to anticipate the threat posed by 1,000 people or 1,500 people, and to use that as a grounds for limiting the protest. And you know, the key there is by anticipation or provocation. So here the Chicago police provoked, as you know, since you researched, you and I talked briefly earlier, in this episode, the strikers had twice before that week marched on the plant and had been the hell beaten out of them by the Chicago police. That itself, in a way, was proof that these people were, you know, that violence could result, and that's played out time and again. And unfortunately, it's an acceptable rationale, in a way, that, you know, you're going to get there, and by your presence, you're going to cause some fracas. We'll enjoin you from setting up your picket.
Is it like a recompense with the conventions today? I mean, is it akin to that in a way? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, in essence, yeah. And the other thing, of course, is that the limitations imposed, whether it's 250 police armed there who beat you up or shoot you and run you away, or whether it's an injunction, as we all know in the labor context, these things are so time sensitive that even if the employer or their agent proves wrong,
if the injunction is issued at the top of it and running away, then when they beat up a bunch of people, that can be mission accomplished, even if ultimately the reason proves illegitimate or the reason for claiming proves illegitimate.
Okay, we're 2 minutes past, 3 minutes past letting you guys out, so I'm going to call a halt now. But the panelists are up here, so feel free to come and ask questions.